The separation between science and human values is an illusion.
Where did we come from?
This is the first self-replicating species on the planet.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag Science Rising.
Now, if, like my wife, during an ill-fated cookery lesson, you have cut off the top of your finger, you'll notice that it will eventually grow back. Cut off a hand, not so much. But why? And if animals can do it, why can't we? And then if we can grow back one hand, could we grow back two? Or maybe three? So many questions I have for our next guest, Professor Mike Levin, who's director at the Allen Discovery Centre at Tufts. Welcome to the programme, Mike. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. We spoke a bit before about how cells know which cells to turn into as they, what's called differentiation, as a cell, you know, goes from being a stem cell into a heart cell or a skin cell or so on. Can you talk to us a little bit about regeneration and how cells know when to grow and what to grow into and how they know to stop?
Certainly. The ability of cells to know what type of cell to become is only the first step towards any kind of maintenance or even repair of a complex anatomy. The most important thing they then need to figure out is what the large-scale structure is supposed to be, what shape of the organ, what size of the organ, where it's to be placed, how it's to be positioned relative to the body, and then, of course, when to stop. So this means that the collection of cells as a whole has to do a lot of computation to figure out what's missing, what needs to be restored, and when the process is complete so that they can stop. And so this is pretty much the most important question facing regenerative medicine in the next century, is to understand how cells are able to communicate with each other to figure out what pattern to make, and then how we can sort of learn to speak that same language and induce them to make whatever patterns we want. And so what our work in the Allen Center and in my laboratory has been over the last years is to uncover a new sort of bioelectric language of cells. So all cells in your body, not just nerve and muscle, but actually all cells, communicate electrically with each other to process these sort of pattern memories to figure out what shape they're supposed to build, and then to assess the current status of that shape and to repair it as needed. And so I think one way to, and this is not the only way, but perhaps a really good way, is to learn to speak that same language, the bioelectric code, as it were, to be able to control this process.
Maybe take us through what we do know about how a cell goes from say, for example, being a stem cell to becoming an arm, say, because each cell does contain DNA, but that's not the whole story, is it?
Well, yes. So every cell contains the DNA of the organism, but what's important to realize is that DNA does not directly code for anatomical structures. What the DNA has inside of it is descriptions of the proteins, the individual pieces that each cell will need to go about its business. But having those pieces is a long way from actually knowing what the shape of the large-scale structure is supposed to be. And so there needs to be all sorts of complicated dynamics that have to do with physics and bioelectricity and chemical gradients. There are many processes that stand between the DNA and the final outcome. And simply looking at the DNA is not sufficient to know what structure is going to be. And so we have to really develop this understanding of how you get from DNA, which encodes protein sequence, to the final three-dimensional structures. And that includes all sorts of chemical reactions and also, very importantly, electrical signaling.
So how long have we known about this electrical signaling between cells?
Well, the reality is that it's been well over 100 years since people have realized that many cells are electrically active and also respond to electrical signals. There was work in the early 1900s, and then more work in the 30s and 40s, and then again in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, looking at how cells respond to applied electric fields, and also looking at some natural electric fields in the body. What has not been appreciated until fairly recently is that cell networks use this electrical signaling to make up decisions about pattern regulation, about shape and growth, and so on. And so this is something that the tools to really understand this at a molecular level, and then to begin to manipulate these electrical signals, have only come online in the last 10 years or so.
So do you have like some sort of metering system? I'm thinking of those screwdrivers that have a light on to tell you whether or not a wire is live, a voltmeter. I mean, presumably these signals are quite faint. Do you have a way of listening to what these signals are? And is it just a matter of voltage, or is there other things going on that make that communication a bit more complex?
Yes, so we have a way of looking at these electrical conversations that cells are having with each other, and the way it works is that there are, for example, chemical dyes, these compounds that will emit a fluorescent light, and the fluorescent light they emit will be brighter or dimmer or change color in proportion to the electrical gradients at each location. And so in the past, what you would have to do is poke each cell with a little glass needle, a little electrode that would then tell you the voltage of that cell, but now we can soak the whole animal or the whole tissue in these dyes, and then use a microscope to collect the fluorescence. And what you have, in effect, you directly see a map of this sort of multicolored map of where all the voltage gradients are in your tissue. And by looking at that and looking at the way this changes through time, you can see all the electrical properties and how they correlate to downstream patterning events. And so that's so seeing these things is the first important step. But even more important is the ability to manipulate. So if you see a particular gradient that's involved in, let's say, eye development, you would like to know if you can recapitulate that same gradient somewhere else in the body and cause an eye to form. And this is just one example of something that we've done in my group. We did this about 6 or 7 years ago. We were able to show that eye development is driven by a particular voltage pattern, and that if you induce this pattern elsewhere, you can induce whole eyes. And so these are the tools that we use to manipulate the bioelectric code.
Yeah. So you've actually grown eyes in the guts of animals by sort of, it's almost, it sounds like pressing a particular playing a particular note on a keyboard. You've basically said, okay, you've got the DNA, here's the activation sequence, and an eye appears.
That's correct. One of the things that we've discovered about this bioelectric code is that while you can use it to control individual cell behavior, so let's say make a stem cell become a particular cell type, the more powerful way to use it is as a sort of master regulator. So there are particular bioelectrical states that kick off a very complex downstream responses. So when we trigger the formation of brain or eye or heart or limb, we don't have to go in and micromanage the process. We don't have to say, well, here you need some bone, and here you need some nerve tissue, and here you need some muscle, and then some skin, and so on. We don't have to micromanage that. We have a particular signal that says, build an eye here, or build a leg here, and then the rest of the body takes that and runs with it. And so this is a very attractive property for regenerative medicine, because it's going to be a long time before we have the capability to really micromanage something as complex as creating an arm. It's much better if we can trigger and control these patterning processes at a higher level, at a sort of module level.
So talk to me about this eye. It was in the gut of what sort of an animal?
It was a tadpole, a froglet.
A frog, okay. And could that eye see?
Yes. So it turns out, and then this is from other work we've done subsequently, it turns out that brains are incredibly plastic, and if you do put an eye onto an aberrant location in the tadpole, let's say on the back or on the tail, that brain has no problem recognizing this weird new tissue as providing visual signals, and those animals learn to see out of that eye and to use it for visual processing.
Whoa! You're saying that you put an eye somewhere else on the body of an animal, and the brain, I thought you would have to cut it off and put it in, you know, attach it somewhere to let it see. But you're saying that the eye grown on a tail of a newt can see.
So this was in a froglet. I assume a newt would be the same. And yes, absolutely. So what happens is, and we've tracked how this works. The ectopic eye connects to the spinal cord. It does not connect to the brain. It connects to the spinal cord somewhere in the back of the tail. And apparently, those visual signals that come in through that eye get put onto this to the spinal cord as a sort of central information bus for the animal, and it makes its way to the brain, and then the brain is able to recognize this as data that it can use to make decisions in visual learning assays. So we train, you know, we basically train these tadpoles to respond to different color lights and do certain behaviors to get rewards and punishments and so on. And yes, that the plasticity of the brain is incredible. And in a way, you would have to, as amazing as this is, in a way you have to expect that, because evolutionarily, if every time evolution discovered some modification of the body that made the animal better, if the brain was not able to take advantage of that and all the behavioral programs fell apart, then that animal would never survive and the body modification wouldn't continue forward in evolution. So for us to for animals to be able to evolve more complex forms, it's almost required that the brain be plastic enough to take its behavioral programs and adaptively transfer them to new body architectures. But it really is remarkable to the extent to which the brain can do that.
So obviously some animals can regenerate limbs that have been cut off. For example, everyone knows salamanders have an amazing regenerative capability. That is present in humans. This, you know, theoretically, we would be able to do this in human beings.
Well, my view on this is the engineering perspective. An engineer basically says that anything that's not forbidden by the laws of physics should be possible. So while I'm not going to try to give you a timeline on when humans are going to be regrowing their arms back, that's impossible to say. I personally firmly believe that it is possible. I don't see any fundamental reason why it shouldn't happen. And by the way, there are mammals that are better at this. So for example, deer, if you think about deer, every year they shed large amounts of antlers. And antlers, remember, are not like horns. So an antler contains true bone, vasculature, innervation, skin, and so on. So deer, every year, they're a mature, large mammal that sheds these antlers and regrows them at the rate of a centimeter of new bone per day. I mean, that's an amazing amount of new bone growth. And so some even some mammals can regenerate. And of course, the human liver is regenerative. So the question is can we activate the program of limb growth in an adult human? Of course, remember, the body already has that program in there. You know, each person created those limbs during embryonic development, so that information is there. The question is, can we activate it during adulthood, and then can we support that limb while it regenerates? And so for this reason, in our work with David Kaplan's lab, who's a bioengineer at Tufts, they make these wearable bioreactors that basically fit onto a limb amputation site and provide an aqueous environment in which all these bioelectric and chemical gradients can be supported while the limb regenerates. So I think it's going to be a combination of this sort of bioreactor and then the appropriate signal that induces the limb growth. And that signal is probably going to be bioelectrical. It may be a combination of that with some chemical growth factors. You know, that remains to be determined.
This is sort of bioreactor. You're saying that your colleague, I may have misheard you, your colleague has sort of... is this on human amputees?
No, we're certainly not. I should make that very clear. We're certainly not working in humans yet, and I get a lot of interest actually from people.
I'm sure
on
you
this,
do,
understandably.
Yeah.
But we are not, just to be super clear, we are not ready for human trials of any kind. We have worked this out in frogs. So we now have frogs that are regenerating their legs, where frogs normally do not do that. And our next step is rats. And after that, we can think about clinical applications. But the idea is, it's basically, if you think about a little cylinder that's packed with fluid and some other electronics and some other interesting things, and this cylinder is fit onto a limb amputation site of a frog or a rat.
Yeah.
And the idea is that what you need for all of these things is two ingredients. You need the right signal that's going to kickstart limb regeneration, and then you need a supportive environment that allows that signal to be imposed on the tissue and supports the tissue as it grows out. So the Kaplan lab makes these wearable bioreactors, these little cylinders into which the limb will grow, and then we work out the electrical code that's going to kickstart the process of limb regeneration.
Theoretically, though, if you got your arm cut off, surely you have to, you know, cauterize the wound. You have to, you know, you have to seal up the limb to stop yourself bleeding to death, right? So, once that has happened, how can you then undo that to allow the limb grow back?
Yes. Right. So the need to seal the wound is probably what drives the mammalian scarring response.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we think it's an evolution. I mean, nobody really knows why some animals have regeneration and others don't. But probably it's because mammals have evolutionarily made the trade-off that it's better to seal the wound, make a scar, and survive rather than risk blood loss and so on. So one of the things that we will definitely have to do in this process is to manage things like inflammation and blood flow and so on. But what happens is that after what we basically need to do is we need to minimize the scarring, and then the wound usually pulls over with what's called a wound epithelium, which is just a very thin, very specialized type of skin that keeps the insides basically from leaking out, but is not so thick and its material properties are not such that it's going to inhibit regeneration. And so the goal is to, obviously, as an emergency measure, yes, absolutely, you have to stop the bleeding, you have to seal the wound, prevent infection. There's all these other issues that are going to be have to solve by human in human medicine. And then, but then after that, you can kickstart growth at the edge of this wound epithelium. And it may well be that if somebody had trauma at some time in the past, in order to kickstart regeneration, we may have to do a kind of re-injury at the front to get rid of some of the scar tissue,
yeah,
and to leave the new tissues right up at the edge of the wound so that they can grow out. But these are absolutely profound problems that will have to be faced.
So you've created a two-headed worm, a tadpole essentially with an eye in its gut. What else have you created? And just out of interest, why do you make the decisions to, say, for example, make a two-headed worm with your science? What's the point of doing these?
Yes, the point of doing all this is that what we need as biomedicine moves forward is we need to exert a control over three-dimensional shape. You know, we are very good, as scientists are now getting very good at controlling individual molecules and maybe even controlling individual cells, but really medically what you want is to control shape. If you could control shape, you would have a solution to birth defects, you would have a solution to regenerative medicine, you would have a solution to cancer, because in many ways cancer is a disease of geometry, as cells sort of abandon their normal pattern-forming functions and form tumors. You may have a solution to aging and degenerative disease if you can keep cells harnessed towards the appropriate body plan. So to my mind, the problem of shape is really the central problem of biomedicine. I mean, there's so many things will be solved if we understood this. So in order to understand shape, we need to understand how animals get their shape in the first place, and then if we have theories on how that works, we need to test those theories by trying to modify the shape. There really is no other way to know, and so this is why we make these other creatures.
How do people react to the news that you're making these sort of creations? Because I suppose it's, to some people there might be an ethical question about that sort of research. How do you respond to that?
Well, there's two ethical questions that one could ask about all this. The first is with respect to the animals themselves, and I think in most societies we've made the decision that we're going to raise animals for food. We're going to eat mammals like cows and so on. And so I think anybody who consumes animals for food really has no argument against the experimentation that's going to help human health. The other argument that one might make is, to what extent are these things a good idea for human applications? I mean, the medical applications are pretty hard to argue against. You know, we have all sorts of pediatric cancers and people born with birth defects. I mean, I think it's pretty morally indefensible to argue that these things should not be fixed.
Mm.
But there is a further question about body modification. And I think that once we gain sort of full control over patterning, it is going to be the case that people in the future are going to have much wider choices as far as, you know, right now we have people modifying their bodies in various ways. We have people with implants and all sorts of things. But in the future, there's going to be much more variety available to people. You know, if you can grow a regular arm with five fingers, if you've decided you want one with seven fingers, I'm pretty sure that's going to be possible, and all sorts of permutations are going to be possible. And so I have no doubt that there are going to be people, like as there always are, that are going to argue that this sort of thing shouldn't be permitted. I mean, that's a discussion people can have. I for one, think that people have been modifying their bodies and their face ever since the first cavemen decided to sort of step out in the rain and you know, gain shelter and not get pneumonia. So medical you know, medical process. Once you start that, like that, medical progress is basically unstoppable.
You think that this is something that people may be able to buy as a service in the future to be able to change their physical body? Because we know people are willing to do crazy things themselves already, even risking serious infection. You know, body modders do that sort of stuff. You think that if this was available as a medical procedure, that people might decide to grow an extra limb on their bodies?
I don't see why not. I mean, in the future, I just looking at how any technological advance has been used in the past, I don't see why not. I mean, people are going to be getting, let's say even in you know, somebody who needs an eye transplant or an eye implant, you know, they may decide that, well, a normal human eye is good, but, you know, I'd like an eye that can see a little bit into the infrared or ultraviolet, or maybe in the future we have people that are going to live their lives in space, and they may have completely different requirements for their body structures.
God, that's crazy, Mike. That's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I suppose we've evolved to this particular thing. Is there a question about whether or not our bodies are presumably quite well tuned to providing the required energy for the number of limbs we have? If we created another limb, would we not also need a stronger heart to pump blood to this extra appendage that we've suddenly grown? I mean, are there not other effects of adding on bits to our bodies?
There may well be, and this is not really well known today. But the plasticity of the body is pretty amazing. If you look at bodybuilders or people who have adapted themselves for high altitude, you know, mountain climbing, and then people who dive deep, underwater without breathing apparatus, this sort of thing. I think the body has a pretty remarkable
flexibility,
capabilities of adapting, and I think my guess is that a single extra limb is not going to be any problem. Going beyond that, there may be limits, but the heart also adapts, of course, to loads put on it. So who knows?
Gosh, it's crazy to think about, isn't it? I suppose there would be critics out there who would say this is not the path to regeneration. Is your approach looking at these electrical signals? Is that, are there competing theories as to how we might be able to get a defective heart that's had tissue death, for example, to regenerate itself?
Yes, there are two. There are at least two other competing approaches. The first, of course, is the field of prosthetics. So for arms and legs, for example, there are lots of people working on mechanical and electronic hybrid systems that will work. And I think that research is very exciting. It certainly is very useful work. And that is a competing technology. It'll be interesting to see which goes first and how far they go. Of course, the important thing about that is that each of those types of organs has to be made independently. That is, you know, once you've solved the mechanical hand problem, that doesn't help you with a mechanical heart or with a mechanical, liver. You would have to solve those independently.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that our approach is a much more general approach, where if we learn to trigger the growth of specific structures, the same general technology can be used as a regenerative therapy for many organs. But that remains to be seen how general. The other thing is that many people in the field are working on chemical signaling as opposed to electrical signaling.
Yeah.
So the majority of people in the regenerative field are hoping to discover a cocktail of growth factors, proteins, small molecules, things like this that will kickstart regeneration. Now many of those people are working on specific tissues. So you know, for example, nervous tissue for spinal cords or for Parkinson's or whatnot. Mm. But there are other people that are hoping that some combination of chemical factors can trigger large scale organ growth as well. So
I thought I thought electrical and chemical signals were almost interchangeable in at the cell level. That you know, for example, neurotransmitters. There's the electricity is created by a chemical interaction, right? Is that not the sort of electricity you're talking about?
Well, they're different in two ways. Chemical and electrical signaling are different in two important ways. The first is the sort of physical nature of it. So chemical signals are propagated by small molecules or even large proteins moving across some distance, you know, from cell to cell or between cells or something like this. Electrical gradients signal by virtue of electrical properties that cells have and that communicate to each other via voltage signals. So they are related, and they're related in the sense that, yes, as you say, in the nervous system, voltage changes give rise to the movement of neurotransmitters, and conversely, neurotransmitters can open and close ion channels, which in turn generates voltage gradients. So this is sort of a bidirectional system that where the chemical and the electrical processes feed back to each other, but they're not identical. They're sort of related to each other. The other important question to ask is what kind of information is processed by these systems. So it turns out that electrical signaling is somewhat unique in being a really convenient medium for computation. And it's not an accident that our brains use electrical networks, and also our computer technology uses electrical networks to process information, store memories, and do computations. And I think that this is one of the most profound aspects of regenerative biology, is to ask not only about the mechanisms and how these cells do what they do, but actually to talk about algorithms and try to understand the computations. How do the cells know what they should be doing? Mm. How do they remember the correct pattern that needs to be there? How do they make decisions about growth and the stopping of growth and so on? And this is the sort of thing that is a very natural set of processes to carry out via bioelectricity. And I think what evolution has discovered early on and then adapted it for behavior in the brain and then for patterning in the rest of the body is how to use these electrical networks to store memories and process information.
I have one final question for you, and this is,
sure.
If it's so easy by manipulating chemical signals, to electrical signals, to create an eye or a second head in a worm, for example, why don't we see more spontaneous limb growth in nature? Why doesn't, you know, if someone's exposed to a particular electrical field, or, you know, or they eat a particular food that's, however it is, or any other exposure to electricity that we surely encounter all the time, why aren't there eyes popping up in people's hands all the time?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I'll start by saying that I certainly hope I didn't give the impression that it's easy to do.
No, but I mean, obviously not easy.
Decade.
No, oh, for sure, not easy, but if it is electrical in nature, we are stimulated electrically in so many different ways. It just seems surprising to me that we don't see these sort of surprises more often, because hardly ever is almost they never happen. Why?
Right. So a few things to think about. The first thing is that this kind of electrical system is quite different than electrical exposure that you might get from holding a cell phone up to your head or standing in front of a monitor or having electrical wiring in your house. So this is a completely those types of things. Those types of electromagnetic exposure do not directly produce the kind of voltage gradients that we're talking about that will alter patterning. So that makes sense. Now, the other thing though is, does this happen? You know, where does this happen, and how often does it happen? And actually, it happens more often than you think. Not with ectopic limbs, but in terms of birth defects due to disruptions in the bioelectrical signal. So there are numerous genetic syndromes that arise. There are genetic syndromes where particular ion channel genes are disrupted that give limb and craniofacial and brain and heart disorders. Yeah. And there are lots of teratogens. There are compounds that humans can be exposed to. If the mother is exposed to them while she's pregnant, there are all kinds of compounds that affect ion channels that give rise to birth defects. Now, the reason you get birth defect as opposed to ectopic limbs is simply that it's much easier to mess up a complex process and to disrupt it than to recreate something meaningful. So it took us, a good decade to learn to induce coherent organs and structures to be formed. But messing up normal development by perturbing these electrical networks, that's trivial, and that happens all the time. It happens naturally in birth defects, and in fact, a lot of these birth defects we never even see, because the fetus is resorbed long before anybody sees it, or in many cases long before people know they're pregnant. So and then other times we do have babies born to term with various birth defects that are so-called channelopathies. These are birth defect syndromes arising from ion channel mutations and dysfunction. And so this actually does happen all the time. Having said all of that, the fact is that evolution works because all of these control networks have a degree of robustness. So all of these things have evolved to have multiple checks and balances and multiple control points and multiple redundant overlapping ways to do the same thing. And so the same is true for chemical signaling. You know, one of the most powerful chemical signals in embryonic development is retinoic acid, which is related to vitamin A. And one might think that if this thing is really important for the formation of the face and limbs and the brain and so on, why is this not going wrong all the time based on diet? And in fact, that can happen if there's too much of a particular element in the diet, that can happen. But mostly, there are these really robust chemical and electrical networks that are able to buffer large variations in external input. We wouldn't be here if that wasn't the case. You know, evolution has resulted in the survival of bodies that are very robust to that kind of thing. So in the end, it means we have to be very clever in how we make these perturbations to have noticeable outcomes, because otherwise it simply won't work. The body can adapt to it.
Well, Professor Mike Levin from the Allen Discovery Center, Tufts, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. #ScienceRising.